from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The set of temporary budget items proposed by Greece, as required by the country's creditors as part of a four-month extension of its debt, has been approved by the European powers that be. RT's Peter Oliver has more.
Greece's short-term financial future does seem like it's been insured. What we've heard from the Eurogroup today, the Eurogroup's made up of the finance ministers of the Eurozone countries, is that they will accept the reforms put forward by Greece. We heard from the head of the Eurogroup earlier on saying there was no plans for a Grexit that would see Greece leave the Euro.
I very much agree with Mario Draghi and Jean-Claude Juncker that Grexit is simply not on the table. It's not discussed. I will not even prepare any thoughts about it.
But not everybody's happy about these reforms. We heard from the International Monetary Fund saying that they want more details to be brought out from the Greek side. And we've also heard from the ECB saying that they're unhappy with some of the fine-tuning, some of the wording in this document that was put forward. Let's have a look at some of the main points, though, that were put forward by Athens. They will see VAT reform. They'll also modernise the way that they track down tax cheats, and they'll also look to prosecute more of them as well. There'll also be a review of public spending to try and see where potential future cuts can be made, and that there will be a balance between dealing with the humanitarian crisis in Greece. Those people that are that have literally nothing left, that they have no money, no ability to buy food, how they're going to deal with them, and also making sure that it has no negative fiscal effect. Well, one of the things that's going to be perhaps the next biggest challenge, apart from persuading the IMF and the ECB that these reforms are the right way forward, will be how it plays out at home. Syriza, the left-wing government, came to power promising to get rid of the status quo. Well, basically, they've just extended the status quo, and some of the more left-leaning people in Greece, well, they're not happy at all. And it's going to be up to Alexis Tsipras, the Greek Prime Minister, to try and assure those people that this is just giving them breathing space while they try and negotiate a more longer-term deal after this extension runs out in 4 months' time.
A poll conducted during the negotiations last week between the Syriza-led Greek government and its European partners revealed that 81% of the population approved of the government's handling of negotiations up to that point. Observers say one of the challenges underlying the New Deal is whether or not the people of Greece, who have been highly mobilized against the austerity measures, will accept the four-month extension. Ukraine has agreed on the need for the urgent and immediate withdrawal of heavy weaponry in the east of the country. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon met with Foreign Affairs Minister Pavlo Klimkin of Ukraine on Tuesday. The accord is part of the Minsk ceasefire agreements signed on February 12th. Jocelyn Sambira reports from the United Nations.
Ban Ki-moon and Ukraine's Pavlo Klimkin agreed on the need to urgently and fully implement a package of measures adopted in Minsk to end the fighting. The 13-point accord includes a lasting and durable ceasefire and immediate withdrawal of heavy weaponry. The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, OSCE, in charge of monitoring the truce in the Eastern European country, echoes this view. In a briefing to the Security Council, OSCE chairperson Serbia's Ivica Dasik said it was high time for peace to take hold.
Ukraine is at a critical juncture. What is needed is full adherence to the ceasefire to allow for the implementation of the other elements of the package, most notably the withdrawal of heavy weapons and equipment. The OSCE Special Monitoring Mission is ready and willing to play its role to facilitate, monitor, and supervise these crucial activities in close coordination with the Trilateral Contact Group.
OSCE has already deployed an observer mission at the Russian checkpoints in Gukovo and Donetsk on the Ukraine-Russian border. Meanwhile, regarding the government's request for a peacekeeping operation in eastern Ukraine, Mr. Ban said the 15-member council would guide the UN on the matter. Jocelyn Sambira, United Nations.
The Eastern Self-Defense Forces have begun to withdraw their heavy weapons as called for under the agreement. Kiev denies this and is accusing the self-defense militias of using the ceasefire as a cover for reinforcements. However, the fighting has eased in eastern Ukraine in recent days. We'll have more on the situation there when we speak with journalist Dmitry Babich from Radio Sputnik in Moscow later in this newscast. The UN Security Council held an open debate Monday on maintaining international peace and security. The session, held at UN headquarters in New York, was placed on the Council's agenda by China. It was presided over by China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi, the president of the 15-nation Security Council for February. He joined the UN Secretary General and more than 80 speakers from member countries in addressing the Council.
Reflect on history, reaffirm the strong commitment to the purposes and the principles of the Charter of the United Nations. The Charter affirms the strong determination of the international community to prevent war and maintain lasting peace. For 70 years, the Charter has inspired one generation after another to make unrelenting efforts for the lofty cause of world peace. China advocates a new thinking of win-win and all-win cooperation, as well as a new concept of community building for shared interests and common destiny.
Venezuela's Foreign Minister Delcy Rodriguez used the occasion to denounce foreign interference and the economic war that's being waged on her country during her presentation.
The matter that brings us here today is ever more relevant in a world where the challenges call into question peace and security. We wish to recall that at the 20th anniversary of the United Nations, there was an adoption of the declaration that prohibits intervention into the domestic matters of states and that declares a respect for sovereignty and independence for our states as essential. Further, at the 25th anniversary, we saw the declaration which says that the only manner in which we can attain the purposes of the UN is if these states can develop themselves with sovereign equality. I'd like to stop on this point because we do know, and the international community can bear witness to the fact that unilateral action through ongoing war and economic warfare and media warfare and financial warfare seek to subject the people with the only objective of taking over natural resources in order to satisfy the hegemonic desires of foreign powers.
The foreign minister also criticized global military expenditures and condemned the fact that racial discrimination continues in the 21st century. Before taking her seat during the special counsel session, Rodriguez tweeted that she planned to bring the voice of Latin America and the Caribbean in defense of international law and national sovereignty to the Council. Venezuela won a seat on the Security Council late last year and took its place January 1st. That country's government of President Nicolas Maduro has been the subject of criticism from corporate media outlets, which have attempted to portray the country as being violent and unstable. But Maduro has been fighting back, as Telesur's Cody Waddle reports from Caracas.
Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro says he will reveal more details Tuesday on the recently thwarted coup attempt. Maduro says that he will present a video that demonstrates the falsehoods being propagated by right-wing sectors who have condemned the arrest of those behind the planned coup on February 12th. That includes Caracas Mayor Antonio Ledezma, who was detained by authorities last week. During a speech on Monday, Maduro also denounced the U.S.'s role in the thwarted coup.
President Obama, get your policies towards Venezuela in order. Take the reins and impose policies that are based on respect. Respect with the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela, because our people will not accept more intervention from your government. And we will not accept more abuses from your embassy.
And meanwhile, many Venezuelans continue to reject the violent destabilization tactics attempted by the nation's opposition now for more than a decade.
We want serious political organizations that really provide answers for their supporters. What has happened to the opposition? It is an opposition that is violent, that is corrupt. It is an opposition that is prepared to do damage to the Republic. We can't allow this, and I don't believe any country in the world would allow it.
If they think that Venezuela is going to change, as they say, the best thing they can do is to put it to a vote. Let's do the math, vote for vote. Nicolás Maduro is the president of Venezuela because we won the elections in 2013. This is something that the opposition doesn't understand. They prefer to take the easy path.
The Bolivarian Republic has garnered widespread support in the region in its defense against U.S. intervention. The regional organization UNASUR, comprised of all 12 of the sovereign nations of South America, has expressed its support for the democratically elected socialist government in Caracas against right-wing extremists who seek to oust the president. Ecuadorian Foreign Minister Ricardo Patiño said Monday that UNASUR will continue to monitor the internal situation and right-wing opposition in Venezuela in order to help ensure both democracy in the country and peace in the region. In a TV interview Monday, Patiño said that UNASUR had played a similar role in February of last year to bring an end to the wave of right-wing violence in the country, in which 43 people were killed. Delegates from UNASUR are set to visit Caracas next week. We have more details in this report from Telesur.
The Secretary General of the Union of South American Nations, UNASUR, Ernesto Samper, said a high-level delegation will visit Venezuela next week in order to meet with officials regarding the right-wing destabilization attempts within the country. The regional body has repeatedly condemned both foreign and domestic plots to undermine the democratically elected government of Nicolas Maduro. Meanwhile, the Cuban government reiterated their support to Venezuela in the wake of ongoing destabilization efforts.
The U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit will hear over the objection of Pacific Gas and Electric and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, a case brought by Friends of the Earth, alleging that the NRC illegally allowed PG&E to alter the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant's license. Friends of the Earth contends that the NRC acted in secret and in collusion with PG&E to hide Diablo Canyon's vulnerability to earthquakes stronger than it was built to withstand. The D.C. Circuit ruled late February 20th not to grant a motion by the NRC and utility to dismiss the case on procedural grounds. Instead, the judges ruled that the case would be heard on its merits. Ukraine has agreed on the need for the urgent and immediate withdrawal of heavy weaponry in the east of the country. The self-defense forces have begun to withdraw their heavy weapons as called for under the agreement. For more on this, we spoke with radio journalist Dmitry Babich from Radio Sputnik in Moscow via Skype Tuesday. What do you have to say about what's happening, and what do you see as the prospects for Ukraine at the present?
Well, the prospects for a ceasefire are not that bad. You know, the meeting of the Russian, French, German, and Ukrainian foreign ministers has just ended in Paris. And Mr. Lavrov, you know, the Russian foreign minister, said that the discussions were fruitful and that he, there was some agreement on the need to strengthen the OSCE mission, not to strengthen the U.S. military aid to Ukraine. So I think that the immediate prospects for the ceasefire can be not that bad. But the overall picture is, of course, rather gloomy, because it's quite clear that the intentions of the Ukrainian government, its demand to control the border with Russia, is unacceptable for the new independent entities in the east of Ukraine, and it's clear that the European Union is still 100% behind Poroshenko. They can't learn to contain his, his emotions.
And what about the wrangling over the peacekeepers, who they'll be, and all of that?
For the peacekeepers, that's a big issue, because it's clear that Mr. Poroshenko wants a peacekeeping mission from the European Union under all the auspices of the UN. But the problem is that The European Union was not neutral in this conflict. The European Union, since November 2013, was 100% behind the revolutionaries and 100% behind the new regime. It didn't find a single word of criticism for Mr. Poroshenko, even when thousands of people were dying in his own country.
Right.
So it's quite clear that the EU peacekeepers will not be acceptable for Donetsk and Lugansk, and especially they will not be acceptable on the border with Russia, you know, on the border between Ukraine and Russia.
Right. For just for people to know, if you look at a map, I mean, what we're talking about here, the Russian border is also the division. It's the division between Donbass region and Russia. So if there's international troops there, the escape route, essentially, if Kiev comes in to slaughter everyone rather than being able to fall back into Russia and be safe, that's cut off. And if you're looking at NATO expansion, what you're doing essentially is now putting NATO right even behind the Donbass, right on the Russian border, which of course is unacceptable to Russia.
Yes, and the other more immediate issue is that the regime in Kiev has stopped all banking transactions in that area. People don't get their pensions, people don't get their salaries. Kiev stopped all food deliveries to that area. It's in a total transportation and economic blockade. So the only food and the only money that this region gets, it gets from Russia via that border.
And that
if the EU controls that border, that will mean that 4 million people will be cut off from any humanitarian assistance,
right.
Because I didn't hear of any humanitarian aid coming to Donbass from countries like England, Poland, or Germany. And this, of course, is not acceptable simply because these 4 million people want to leave, they want to eat, they need gas, which the Ukrainian government has just stopped supplying there. They need money for their pensions. And they simply won't agree to have it all cut off from them, because that's the idea of the new regime in Kiev, to make these people surrender simply because they won't have anything to eat.
And in military terms, it would essentially constitute an encirclement of Donbass by Ukraine.
Well, you know, this is the huge controversy, who supplies weapons to whom in this war. I would say that in general, we should remember that this is primarily a civil war. It's not a Russian invasion. It's a civil war between citizens of Ukraine of different political orientations. It's not even an ethnic conflict, because you have a lot of, for example, ethnic Ukrainians who are believers of the Orthodox Church of Ukraine, you know, the Moscow Patriarchate. And these people are opposed to the new regime because this regime is openly hostile to that old church of Ukraine. And you have lots of ethnic Russians fighting in the forces sent by Kiev to quell the rebellion in Donbass.
Right. Right. I mean, it's very difficult to parse out who's who with the long associate. You know, the Russia and Ukraine have been together for, you know, 1,000 years. So it's hard to parse
that's,
out.
That's exactly true. And the problem is that this area, I mean, there was no border there for centuries.
Right.
This was a so-called wild field. So, in fact, even when Russia, you know, the Russian state did not exist, and, you know, before the 17th century when Ukraine became part of the Russian Empire, even then there was no definite border. So when the West wants this border to be sacrosanct, and when the West wants Cossacks from Rostov not to see their friends and relatives in Donetsk, and they formed the same entity for centuries, you know, the Cossack troops, as they were called. So it's technically and spiritually impossible, I would say.
Meanwhile, while Kiev cuts off gas and oil supplies to the east, Russia has now started playing hardball with Kiev, which has been very slow in paying for the Russian gas and oil that it relies on. And we're 2 days away, perhaps, from a cutoff there?
Well, it's very hard to predict what will happen, because in general, Russia made it clear that it doesn't want in future to provide gas to Europe through Ukrainian territory. It's a risky area for gas deliveries. It has been a risky area for two decades at least. You know, lots of gas were just siphoned off. So the Russian plan is to offer the European consumers, you pick up your gas at the border between Turkey and Greece. One of the ways out would be for the pipeline from Greece to go to Serbia and then to Hungary. And Mr. Putin has discussed it with the Hungarian Prime Minister, Viktor Orban. But that caused an outcry in the EU. Again, the EU officials are not happy. Before, they were not happy with the South Stream, which was supposed to replace Ukraine as the transit route for Russian gas deliveries to Europe. Now they are unhappy with the Hungarian transit territory. So it's very hard to satisfy them, but the problem is that the European Union needs Russian gas. And if Ukraine becomes a problem, if it becomes an unsafe transit country, then this problem will have to be resolved somehow for Europe. Mm.
And that provides some interesting context to all of the machinations that are going on with the global petroleum markets, doesn't it?
Yes, that's true. But, gas prices, this is one thing, and the energy needs of Europe is another problem.
That's right.
Whatever the prices, Europe simply needs Russian gas because, you know, the gas that it gets from Norway, the gas that it gets from Algeria, this is not enough, and sometimes this is a way too expensive. So Russian gas has always been, at least during the last 50 years, it has been a part of the European energy diet. And, Europe will have to find a way to somehow reconcile its ambitions about control of Ukraine with the need to get Russian gas.
And the financial side of this is an interesting contradiction as well, because on the one hand, if you were to take the view that the U.S. was driving down the oil prices to make it more difficult for Russia, on the other hand, they priced themselves out of the market because of the increased production costs, for example, shale extraction, et cetera, and then transportation from North America. It's interesting to see how it's almost like getting painted into a corner.
Yeah, that's true. But, let me remind you that the contract that Yulia Tymoshenko signed with Putin in 2009, it was, the price of gas was tied to the price of oil. So the contract would be good to Ukraine if the oil prices had fallen. That didn't happen. And immediately Mrs. Tymoshenko was accused of ignoring the directives of the president of Ukraine, Yushchenko. And this was a very right accusation. She didn't have the right to sign that contract. You remember how the West stood 100% behind Mrs. Tymoshenko, and the West was ready to impose sanctions on Ukraine for just one person.
Right.
Now we have hundreds of people in jail for political reasons in Ukraine. We have 5,000 people killed at least. We have terrorist acts in Kharkiv with, dozens of people already arrested arbitrarily. And the West is not even thinking about imposing sanctions on Mr. Poroshenko. Quite on the contrary, he was offered a loan of $40 billion from the IMF.
And then the former foreign minister, under the deposed government, Prime Minister Azarov, had announced his readiness the other day to assemble a government in exile?
He wrote a very interesting book, which was published in Russia, and I think it's very interesting to read it, because actually it reveals the true relationship between Ukraine and the EU. You know, the EU membership was never on the cards for Ukraine. And it will not be. So this is the main message from the book. The other interesting things which Azarov mentioned is the fact that basically there was a lot of economic pressure from the EU for Ukraine to sign this association agreement. And Azarov claims that the whole shooting incident on Maidan, when so many people were killed, that it was not the police, but rather the so-called peaceful protesters. Who could be involved in that. But immediately after that book was published, somehow the Ukrainian government found Mr. Azarov to be a criminal, and they immediately started a criminal case against him. That's interesting. For a whole year, they seem to have forgotten about him. As soon as that book was published and he gave a press conference, suddenly several articles of the criminal code were activated.
They want to shut him up. In the larger picture, in the larger picture with the sanctions that the U.S. and EU have had against Russia, Russia is still not without, I would say, tools or weapons to deal with that. And the model of Greece being held before Ukraine for what the relationship with the EU could mean, you know, stands out glaringly. Do you see Russia maybe getting involved in providing some either assistance or some sort of pivoting leverage for Greece and maybe ultimately Spain and Portugal as well?
Well, the Greek government is pretty friendly towards Russia, at least rhetorically. But I think that the Russian government is under no illusions about the democratic nature of the EU and about the consensus rules there. It's quite clear that the EU is very similar to the Soviet kolkhozes. Formally, every member has the right to block, the collective decision. But everyone understands that this dissenting member will have some very serious problems very soon. So it's just it's out of the question that anyone would vote against. And this is exactly the problem with Greece. Greece was made to understand that if they try to play with sanctions against Russia, they will face very, very bad consequences. So I don't think Greece or Hungary, unless there is an attempt by the EU indeed to change the government in a violent way there, I don't think that these people, Orban or Tsipras, will indeed try to block anti-Russian sanctions inside the EU. As for Spain and Portugal, they're controlled by neoliberals.
Right now,
neoliberals are still in power in Spain. People are unhappy, but there is simply no alternative. And even if there had been an alternative, like there was an alternative in Greece, it turned out that the so-called austerity policy, it had been already written into law. So I'm not sure even if a different government comes to power in Spain or in Portugal, I'm not sure this government would be able to change the course that had been taken earlier.
One of the tools that was used in the Western Hemisphere and Latin American Caribbean region for removing various countries from the control of the neoliberal model was Venezuela using oil and the financing of oil to reduce the overall costs to the various states, which changed their balance of payments and allowed them additional leverage and maneuvering room in negotiating their debt. The oil ministers and foreign ministers of Venezuela and Ecuador were in Moscow last week and met with their counterparts there, at least with the oil ministers in Moscow, and then went to Greece with rumors that they were discussing that, and a statement from Venezuela citing their earlier historic experience in Latin America and the Caribbean. Is it possible that some sort of assistance in the form of either development of transit for oil with involving Greece and or subsidies of petroleum products by either Greece, Venezuela, some combination of those could help Greece attain some leverage in the negotiations?
Well, I think that, of course, theoretically this is possible, and Russia has already been using the Venezuelan method, offering preferential gas deals to strengthen the sovereignty of the countries like Serbia or Hungary, or we offered it even to Bulgaria. But I think it is not possible at the moment. We need another big crisis inside the EU. I'm sure that this crisis will happen, because the economic policy of the EU is wrong, and the foreign policy of the EU is a disaster. I think it will take another, or maybe two crises inside the EU for the bloc indeed to start, to disintegrate and for Russia to be able to offer an alternative.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.